Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dan, nice picture behind your head, like the political analyst out of London. And as always, I appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Sign out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut-taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَاقِبَةُ كذبين. إن تحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين. وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, Serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejectors. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Russia says U.S. pilots are violating safety protocols designed to deter a possible clash between the two countries in Syria. U.S. announces a new $300 million arms package for Ukraine, including artillery ammunition and anti-aircraft missiles. And heavy fighting is reported from Sudan's capital hours after the army withdrew from truce talks with its rival paramilitary force. Our top story for this half hour: Russia says the U.S. keeps violating the deconfliction protocols that were designed to deter a possible clash between forces of the two countries operating in Syria. The accusation comes from the head of the Russian Reconciliation Center for Syria. He's been quoted as saying that American pilots activate their weapons systems when approaching Russian planes in eastern Syria. He describes such actions of the U.S. Air Force as gross violations of the agreed protocols. Previously, the Russian military official also condemned Washington for flying its aircraft in zones it had agreed to not enter. Moscow has been providing aerial support to Damascus to fight terrorism. That's why the U.S. keeps maintaining its troops and authorization from the Syrian government. Syria accuses the U.S. of occupying its lands in order to plunder natural resources. The United States has announced another military aid package for Ukraine as the West keeps supplying Kiev with more weapons despite Russia's warnings. The new military assistance comes as Ukraine is preparing for a counteroffensive against Russian forces. The $300 million package includes munitions for air defense systems and tens of millions of rounds of artillery ammunition. It also contains anti-aircraft Stinger missiles. The new package will bring the sum of U.S. security assistance to Ukraine to $37.6 billion since the war began last year. Russia has warned time and again that continued supply of Western arms to Ukraine will only serve to prolong the war. Earlier, we talked to political analyst Glenn Deason about Washington's role in the war between Russia and Ukraine. He believes the U.S. has been seeking to prolong the conflict.
Advice on several occasions, as well as the British government, suggested the goal should be to have regime change in Moscow, that Putin has to go. You have key Republicans such as Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Dan Crenshaw, and others arguing that, you know, this is a good war for them because, you know, they have now the position to, the opportunity to effectively bleed Russia. They can weaken and defeat and or weaken an adversary at least without losing any American soldiers. This is what retired U.S. General Kellogg said as well, that this should be considered a good war because, again, They can try to weaken Russia significantly without using any Americans, and then America can focus on China instead. So I think that the objectives have been, while it not always been made clearly official, they've been quite obvious or open about it from day one. Even the Lloyd Austin, the defense minister, who's very openly said that the objective of the United States is to weaken Russia. So it's not a big secret anymore what the objective is. So I think if you can prolong this war for as long as possible, keep it going, and have a forever war draining Russian resources, it would be in American interests.
There appears to be no signs in a let-up in the Ukraine war as both sides have launched fresh assaults on each other's territories. At least three people were killed in a Russian air attack on the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, early Thursday. Meanwhile, five people were wounded by overnight shelling of the Russian town of Shebekino that damaged several buildings as well. Two people were hospitalized as a result of the Ukrainian rocket strike. Ukraine has stepped up its attacks inside Russia as well as in Russian-held territories in the country's eastern regions this week. Over the past couple of days, Ukrainian forces have reportedly targeted homes, a school, and industrial facilities inside Russia, leaving multiple casualties. Moscow also accuses Kiev of conducting drone strikes, calling them acts of terror. And for 5 months, France has been consumed by social unrest over a two-year increase in the retirement age. Many predict the coming week will be decisive, but few expect France's powerful president to budge. Rami Mazari has more from Paris.
Teachers and railroad workers led strikes nationwide in France, but the fight against the two-year pension age hike via presidential decree is heading towards what seems like a conclusion. Upset over being bypassed, Parliament is expected to hold a vote on the age increase next week, but it seems like a formality. The conservative-dominated upper house appears certain to back President Emmanuel Macron's latest executive order. Next week, we'll also see the 15th million-person march this year against the age hike, but that may be the last one. Many speculate that the hardline government has successfully ignored saucepan-banging protesters, financially exhausted striking workers, and worn down a nation in seemingly constant battle over right-wing austerity measures.
Qui sont des institutions antidémocratiques.
It's clear that Macron has all the institutions of France's Fifth Republic behind him, which are all anti-democratic institutions, and that he will not stop using them against the will of the majority and against the French people. We don't have any illusions about these institutions anymore, and something is growing in the minds of the French the more that Macron refuses to compromise, that the only thing left is a general strike to shut down the country.
The age increase was alleged to be urgent in order to plug a 10 billion euro gap in a pension system which requires 340 billion annually, creating controversy over a minor 3% deficit in a program and from the increasingly volatile salaries and record prices. Western sanctions against Russia, along unrest in Ukraine, continue to backfire, and the strikes include wage increase demands alongside resistance to the pension age decree.
Across all sectors, there are demands for an increase in salaries, which simply can't be ignored any longer. The government hasn't increased the salary of government workers since last summer, which seems like a lifetime ago in terms of our purchasing power.
Calls for the second general strike in the past 4 years continue to be ignored by the nation's mainstream media, as do protests by the once intensely motivating Yellow Vest Group. There continues to be massive public opposition to the second pension age hike in 13 years, but unrest may peak and then start to decline next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Heavy fighting is reported from Sudan's capital hours after the army withdrew from truce talks with its rival paramilitary force. Sudanese army forces launched heavy artillery attacks on bases of the rapid support forces in Khartoum earlier. A Sudanese government official said the country's army had suspended its participation in truce talks with the RSF. The official accused the paramilitary forces of failing to observe a short-term ceasefire, which required their withdrawal from hospitals and residential buildings. On Monday, the U.S. and Saudi mediators said the warring parties had agreed to extend an initial week-long humanitarian truce by 5 days. The mediators have blamed both sides for violating the truce. A power struggle between the army and the RSF erupted into conflict in mid-April, which has claimed hundreds of lives so far. Foreign ministers from the BRICS countries are meeting in South Africa as the bloc seeks to counterweight the West. South African authorities have confirmed the presence of top diplomats from Brazil, Russia, and India, as well as a Chinese deputy minister in Thursday's meeting in Cape Town. The talks are a prelude to a leaders' summit to be held in Johannesburg in August. No agenda has been made public, but discussions are expected to focus on ties among members and an expansion of the group. BRICS is an acronym for five economies of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It has gradually turned into a more cohesive geopolitical bloc. BRICS leader out admitting new members, including Iran and Venezuela. South Africa has invited the Iranian foreign minister to attend the meeting. Hossein Amir Abdullahian is scheduled to hold bilateral talks with his BRICS counterparts.
In its second decade, BRICS has emerged as the world's most powerful grouping, with expanding recognition for being the locomotive of global growth. But BRICS' economic rise also marks an important geopolitical drift, as this grouping has come to be seen as an alternative to the US-led liberal world order. For instance, BRICS' collective gross domestic product has surpassed the US-led group of seven in purchasing power parity terms, while the collective GDP of the G7 shrank from 50.42% of world GDP in 1982 to 30.39% in 2022, BRICS GDP for the same period enhanced its shares from 10.66% to 31% as well, while the COVID-19 pandemic set in deceleration of the G7 economies. BRICS economies, especially those of China and India, continued to show strong potential. Also, the Ukraine war has set the stage for BRICS becoming increasingly conspicuous, as the grouping is seen as the most reliable partner for Russia. In addition, they have also not collaborated with Western economic sanctions that seek to impose obligations on other nations. Also, while the United States has been busy raising a coalition of 50 or so nations to supply Ukraine for its war efforts, South Africa, the current chair, has prioritized BRICS playing a greater role in ending the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. This clearly reflects the new bold BRICS, in face of the International Criminal Court having issued arrest warrants for Russia's president, Vladimir Putin. South Africa has announced diplomatic impunity to all officials from Russia. This confidence and enthusiasm, both within BRICS and about BRICS, makes their parlays both interesting and intriguing, with implications way beyond these five nations. For instance, about 24 nations have expressed interest in joining the BRICS grouping. About 20 have formally applied for membership. These applicants include nations from across the world, including Algeria, Argentina, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Belarus, Egypt, Indonesia, Iran, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, Sudan, Thailand, Venezuela, and so on. Expanding intra-BRICS trade has been the primary tool for strengthening the forum. This has lately seen increasing focus on exploring alternatives to reduce their dependence on the US dollar, and creation of a BRICS currency is expected to be on top of their agenda this week.
Granted diplomatic immunity to officials attending a BRICS foreign ministers meeting this week and the grouping's heads of state summit in August. The move has been in reaction to International Criminal Court's warrant to arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin over the war in Ukraine.
South Africa's leading opposition party said on Tuesday it had taken legal action to force the government to arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin if he were to attend a planned summit in the country. In March, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against Putin, who is to visit Cape Town for a Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa bloc meeting in August. On Tuesday, the Democratic Alliance Party said it launched a court application to ensure the government detains the Russian leader and hands him over to the ICC should President set foot in South Africa. Meanwhile, the African National Congress Secretary General has blasted the West's pressure on his country.
Putin is a head of state. Do you think that a head of state can just be arrested anywhere? How many crimes have your country committed? How many crimes have everyone else who's so vocal today committed in Iraq and Afghanistan? Have you arrested them?
The Kremlin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Tuesday that Russia will take part in the summit at the proper level. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also confirmed he will attend the BRICS Foreign Ministers meeting at the end of this week in Cape Town. Russian officials had previously said that Putin had been invited to attend the summit. The Democratic Alliance's legal action comes as the government granted diplomatic immunity to officials attending a BRICS Foreign Ministers meeting this week and the group's head of state summit in August.
An Australian war veteran has lost a defamation lawsuit against some newspapers that had accused him of committing war crimes in Afghanistan. Sydney's federal court has ruled that the newspaper successfully proved the truthfulness of reports in relation to Ben Robert Smith. Three newspapers had accused a soldier of involvement in the unlawful killings of multiple unarmed Afghan civilians during his deployment to Afghanistan. In addition to assault and torture of Afghan detainees, Robert Smith also bullied at least one fellow soldier. The Australian government is currently investigating the alleged murders of more than 50 Afghan civilians by the country's special forces. Canberra deployed its troops to Afghanistan in 2001 as part of the so-called U.S.-led coalition against war on terror. Australia pulled its troops out of Afghanistan back in 2011. Elsewhere, the U.S. House of Representatives has voted to raise the government's debt limit just 5 days before the deadline to avoid a crippling default. The bipartisan bill was approved after the deeply divided House voted 314 to 117 to suspend the government's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling through January the 1st, 2025. Now the bill must be passed by the Senate before the end of the week. President Joe Biden welcomed the passage of the bill, urging the Senate to pass it as quickly as possible so that he can sign it into law. Biden had earlier urged lawmakers to pass the deal to take the threat of default on America's economy or the American economic recovery. The bill was passed after weeks of heated debate as Republicans wanted spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. North Korea says it will soon put another military surveillance satellite into orbit a day after its first attempt at satellite launch failed. The announcement was made in a statement by Kim Yo-jong, sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. She said the North must make greater efforts to develop reconnaissance satellites, given the West's fear of Pyongyang's growing access to information means. Kim emphasized that her country will take any step necessary to defend its sovereign rights and interests. She also dismissed criticisms of Wednesday's test to self-contradiction, saying the U.S. and other countries have launched thousands of satellites. On Thursday, North Korea published images of what it said was a new satellite carrying rocket lifting off from a coastal launch pad. Canadian firefighters are battling hard to contain wildfires in Nova Scotia province, which they have described as unprecedented. Additional firefighting kits have been shipped in from Ontario, while a dozen water bombers are trying to douse the flames. The Canadian military has been also asked to help. So far, 14 wildfires have been reported in Nova Scotia, three of them out of control, including one threatening the suburbs of Halifax. The wildfire burning northwest of Halifax has displaced more than 16,000 residents after an evacuation order was issued for thousands of homes. The fires have so far destroyed or damaged more than 200 structures in Nova Scotia, but no human casualties have been reported yet. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. Appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the thing after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. health through which I may have the strength to obey thee, the worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward, plenty in my state through lawful provision, and that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security, and placest me in thy fortress against the striking of warring Zenobs. Bless Muhammad and his household, and make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Hamid Nouri's kangaroo court in Sweden, conspicuous by its lack of justice. Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri has been locked up in solitary confinement in Sweden for about 3.5 years. The illegal detention and some might say abduction of Hamid Nouri at Stockholm Airport when his plane landed in Stockholm in Sweden on 9th of November 2019 has shocked many in the Islamic Republic of Iran. He has been deprived of many of his rights in solitary confinement under the harshest of conditions, with very little contact with the outside world. It has been a very tough 3.5 years for Hamid Nouri and his family members and loved ones. Please stay with us. The 10th hearing of the court was convened last week, and the 11th court session was held on Monday, 29th of May. These court appearances will continue until at least early to mid-November 2023. In his first court appearance in Sweden, Hamid Nouri strongly objected to the kangaroo-type court where his guilt was presumed without good evidence. In effect, he was assumed to be guilty until proven innocent. Hamid Nouri strongly objected to the judge by saying, "My guilt has been presumed. The decision has been made to convict me, and this court simply rubber stamps that decision." "Why set up this kangaroo court?" he asked. "Justice is sorely missed here. I want to speak to my up for 3 years and 2 months. I asked the honourable judge to allow justice to be done in this courtroom. I have counted every hour and every second to be given the chance to present my own case and to tell you my side of the story. I ask you once again not to convene this rubber stamp court." Hamid Nouri, an Iranian citizen, was arrested by Swedish police when his plane landed in Stockholm Airport on 9th of November 2019. His rough handling by Swedish police and long detention in solitary confinement, and the fact that for several months he was not allowed to contact his family members, and Iranian diplomats and consular staff were not allowed to visit him in prison, were all real causes for concern. The case against him seems to be entirely based on various claims made by the notorious MKO, the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization, claims which are contradictory, totally inconsistent, and in some cases, patently false. It should be remembered that the 1963 Vienna Convention on Consular Relations requires all governments to promptly inform the relevant embassy, diplomatic staff or consular staff once they arrest a foreign national in their country. It is not too far-fetched to suggest that Hamid Nouri was abducted by Swedish authorities just minutes after his arrival in Sweden. A similar predicament occurred to the Iranian diplomat Asadullah Asadi, who was freed recently after 5 years of imprisonment from a Belgian prison. Asadi's case was pursued persistently through legal and diplomatic channels, and the effort finally bore fruit after 5 years. It should be noted that contrary to the 1963 Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, the Swedish authorities did not inform the Iranian embassy staff or Iranian consular staff in Sweden once they had arrested Hamid Nouri. The case against Hamid Nouri is based upon shaky legal principles and legal ground. From a human rights point of view and from an international convention's point of view, the case against Nouri is certainly questionable. There seems to be many inconsistencies in the case against Hamid Nouri, and Swedish authorities have been unable to give a satisfactory answer to any of these. The fundamental legal principle that a person is assumed to be innocent until proven guilty in a court of law has not been applied and has not been heeded in Hamid Nouri's case. The ruling of the preliminary court against Hamid Nouri shows that this fundamental and well-established legal principle has not been heeded. The drawing up of an indictment against him also indicated the same. Almost all legal experts agree that Hamid Nouri's prosecution is fundamentally a political matter rather than being a legal or judicial matter. A plethora of human rights laws, international laws, and even Sweden's own domestic laws were violated or ignored in the manner in which Hamid Nouri was arrested, detained, incarcerated, and legally prosecuted by the Swedish authorities. It should also be noted that during his 3.5 years of incarceration, Hamid Nouri has spent all of that time in solitary confinement under the harshest of conditions, being only allowed to be in open air for just 1 hour in every 24-hour period. The Swedish authorities have also refused to provide Hamid Nouri with even the most essential and basic of items, such as halal food, a copy of the Holy Quran, a prayer rug or prayer mat, suitable glasses for his eyes, and very often they confiscated the notes that he wrote down, even though he protested strongly against this practice. He has also been subjected to torture and beatings quite often. He has also changed prisons several times during the past 3.5 years of incarceration. According to Eduardo Toledo, the legal advisor to the Nouri family, the structure of laws in Sweden is outdated. In fact, the laws which govern Hamid Nouri's case go back to the period 1980 to 1988. But the Swedish government, after the Rome Convention was ratified, updated its set of laws in 2010 and again in 2014. But according to this, laws which were only ratified in 2010 and 2014 cannot be applied to Hamid Nouri's case, which goes back to the 1980s. It should also be noted that Hamid Nouri at one stage during his incarceration was infected by the coronavirus, but he was denied medical treatment by the Swedish authorities. In fact, It can be said that Nuri has been kept incommunicado, without any contact with his family members and the outside world, for a very long time in prison in Sweden.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
We've seen videos and images on the internet with this writing on them. This spot on Earth is a real haven. Lush green forests, beaches with white sands, the water in the sea that's so pure it looks like glass, and a unique wildlife. I mean, somewhere like Borneo in Southeast Asia, an island that's divided between three countries, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the tiny state of Brunei. When you go to a whopping mall for your daily shopping, when you're sitting in a restaurant to eat dinner, when you wash your hair with shampoo in the bathroom, you're biting off a piece of chocolate, when you're using cosmetics, and in many other things you do during the day, you're in fact using palm oil. Almost 80 kilograms for each person annually. Now, if we know that 85% of the palm oil in the world comes from Indonesia and Malaysia, we can ask a few important questions. Who's burning the forests? Who's polluting the air? Are the poor farmers in Borneo behind the increased levels of CO2 in the air, or is it the people who buy and use palm oil every day more than before? During the past 20 years, Malaysia's palm oil exports have increased 1,500 times, and the turnover now stands at over $21 billion. The country is a top producer of palm oil in the world. The world's never-ending demand for palm oil has made the people in Indonesia to break the boundaries. Instead of planting rice and vegetables, despite the hardships and enjoying the beauties of the nature in the country, they've opted for industrial farming of palm trees with a shorter life but with more amenities. We're talking about $400 of monthly income for a 2-hectare farm with about 400 palm trees. The income isn't considered meager in Southeast Asia,
It can tempt anyone.
In many other regions, too, rainforest is being burnt down. 2.6 million hectares have been destroyed, a region almost the size of Belgium. Palm oil companies are responsible for about half the fires laid. Who did this?
They can't find the arsonists, or don't want to find them. But everything here was burnt down, even our fields and houses.
I've lived in London for more than 18 years. I came here from New York. But as much as I've always loved Britain, there was something that bothered me from the start, a thickness to the air, the smell of exhaust that hit me every time I walked outside. It was only years later, when I was working on an article about air quality at the 2012 Olympics, that I sat down to read some of the science of what air pollution does to our bodies and how much of it there is here in London. It only took a few minutes of Googling for me to see that the fumes I dismissed as a nuisance were actually toxic.
There have been numerous similar scandals in recent years. Gardner has highlighted one of them that has to do with Boris Johnson, former UK Prime Minister and London Mayor. According to the research, when Johnson was the Mayor of London, he had gotten dust particle suppressants sprayed around air quality monitors to bring down their readings. These deceptive methods are for advanced countries. In impoverished nations, things are different.
For a long time, we didn't have a choice about relying on fossil fuels, but we don't need them anymore. It's time to move towards something better, toward a future built on clean energy from the wind and the sun. Electric cars instead of diesel and petrol. Less driving, more walking and cycling. It won't be easy to end the era of fossil fuels. They're woven into the fabric of our societies. And there is a lot of money and a lot of power invested in keeping us dependent on them.
In 1952, 7 years after World War II, countries were seeking to accelerate their production. Factories working at full blast every day, millions of tons of charcoal were burnt in the world to help the factories keep producing. London was in ruins due to the Second World War. Those days, it was still the biggest city in the world with a population of 8 million people. Almost all of the population and the factories around London used charcoal to... December 5th, 1952 went down in history forever. In just 4 days, the sulfuric steam claimed 4,000 lives. The figure later rose to 12,000 people. About 100,000 people were infected with various diseases. Officials throughout the United Kingdom introduced a strange strategy to eradicate the mysterious disease. Soon, everyone was talking about offshoring pollution. Today, China is the second largest economy in the world. Many economic analysts believe that the country will take over the U.S. and take the first spot in a few years. The big stride was made thanks to the hard work by millions of laborers in tens of thousands of small and large factories in the country. Everything in the country was developing, even pollution. In Beijing, mothers get up every morning, and first thing in the morning, they go to their children to check if they're still breathing. Preparing breakfast comes next. Everything has to be washed with the water that's purified under the sink. But the water isn't for drinking. they can only drink potable water. That's how a day begins in polluted Beijing. People have to be careful from morning to night, be careful about the water they drink and the food they eat to make sure they're not polluted. A large population of poor people lives in this city. Living in luxury homes is a dream that will never come true. But when it comes to pollution, people's wealth cannot change anything. According to a survey by Nanjing University, a third of all deaths in China is related to air pollution. The research was carried out in November 2015 on 33 million people in 74 cities in China, and it came to light that 31% of the fatalities are linked to air pollution. The largest number of deaths took place in Hebei province, where Beijing is located and is in the worst. In fact, Beijing is made up of two cities, a part of the city where the rich people could enjoy a better air quality and the polluted part where a large number of poor people reside. The rich people live in the cleaner part of the city. On the polluted days, they can go to work in their own cars, have access to better doctors, and have another house in the suburbs to go to and get fresh. Thanks to air purifying machines, the air inside the homes of the richer people in Beijing is purified with more expensive filters. An ordinary purifier costs $4,300 in Beijing. It pumps in the air from the outside and pumps the air into the home after purifying it. But a machine that can completely purify the air and stop carbon dioxide and other pollutants from entering the home with stronger filters costs about $7,200. The filter needs to be changed once a month. Each filter costs $430. A water purification filter costs $300, and the figure can be as high as... People in Beijing are usually seen with face masks on in the streets. These circumstances have led to the emergence of bizarre products in stores throughout Beijing. For example, a bottle of the UK's air is sold at the exorbitant price of $115. The air that was once the most polluted in the world, but now, thanks to exporting pollution, it is clean. Or at least thanks to the deceptive measure by Boris Johnson, it is passed off as clean. Every year, about 20,000 people in Southeast Asia die due to pollution from burning charcoal. The figure can reach an annual casualty of 70,000 people in 2030. The number of power plants that run on charcoal in Malaysia, as the most populated country in the region after China, 323 from 147. In Myanmar, we expect to see a five-fold increase, and the current three power plants will increase to 16 charcoal-fueled power plants. Charcoal is inexpensive and has pushed even advanced countries like South Korea and Japan to devise plans to establish fossil fuel power plants, especially charcoal. It can make the situation even worse. But the pollution in Indonesia and Vietnam will be worse. Power plants in those countries are fast mushrooming. You'll be even more shocked if you know that 100,000 people die every year in India because of the complications related to the power plants.
By 2021, diesel fuel here will meet European standards. The government has also promised to shut down old coal-fired plants and restrict new ones. But pollution has been worsening for years. The Indian government says it's taken steps to reduce pollution. But in the meantime, for years to come, India's capital, and for that matter, most of its major cities, will continue to be among the most difficult places on Earth to breathe.
China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. The country consumes charcoal 40 times more than Indonesia. Only in 2013, 366,000 Chinese lost their lives to bad effects of using charcoal. So why don't the people in China and Southeast Asia do something for themselves to tackle the situation? Lies in offshoring pollution. When London and other metropolises in the world face air pollution during the past decades, they came up with a solution. They decided to relocate the factories that cause pollution away from their countries and only manage them from a distance. On paper, the decision would benefit the poorer countries as well because it would create jobs for them and would transfer technology as well. As a result of the decision, thousands of major and minor companies are operating in Southeast Asia, poor African countries, and Latin America. They can produce anything at the lowest cost compared to advanced countries. The reason is the low cost of production in those countries, inexpensive fuel, inexpensive land, and low wages of manpower. Lack of rules and regulations that work as roadblocks and many other factors in these countries turn them into favorite spots for making products, but their citizens do not benefit from it that much, and the only thing they get in return is air pollution, disease, and a meager amount of money that only keeps them afloat. Agyoblushi is a small but famous region in Accra, the capital of Ghana. This is a terminal ward for many things, from cars, tires, and various machines to television sets and many other electric appliances. Every year, about 215,000 tons of electric appliances are sent to Agyoblushi. Only 30% of them are brand new. The rest are second-hand goods that have to be demolished. In fact, people in Ghana are tasked to ruin these devices at this point. The only thing that is left from them is smoke, black smoke that's always there in the sky. It can be dioxide, any other pollutant you can think of. Most of these goods are sent from rich countries to Ghana as piles of garbage. People in this country do everything to stay alive and eat. Gutting a clunker is the most honorable job in Ghana. After separating the parts, they put aside the useful parts. When they remove the body and the main components, they reach metals that don't reveal themselves so easily, like copper wires that are hidden under plastic covering. The most common way to reach the precious metal is to burn the wire. After the plastic covering is burned, they collect the remaining metal. This is exactly what happens to computers, cables, and electric appliances in the kitchen. It seems damaging, burning, and collecting the leftovers are a win-win for both sides of the deal. One side of the deal gets rid of the garbage and the environmental hazards caused by it, and those on the other side of the deal can eat a few good meals and keep waiting for the cargo ships arrive that are going to bring in the new piles of garbage. The glamorous world today needs to keep producing goods in order to remain sustainable. The goods are advertised every day on billboards. They're put on display in galleries. Many people are ready to stand in long lines for hours to get them. But producing these goods involves expenses, and producers are always desperate to reduce those expenses. In today's world, there has been a simple division of labor. In part of the world, people work all day long in factories and workshops for other people in other parts of the world. In some parts of the world, people create, and people in other parts of the world burn that garbage. In the world, people live, and in the world, people are just trying to. Division of labor is a slogan, but in practice, something else happens.
In the limelight.
Palestinians say the Zionist regime's siege on Gaza has crippled the enclave's economy. The fishing zone for the Gazans currently extends to only between 11 kilometers and 28 kilometers off the Gaza coast. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "It is early morning, sunny but with a cool breeze. Jihad al-Hissi is busy helping fellow fishers to prepare a boat for a day at sea. There should not be anything unusual about the tasks they perform. Fishers around the world do them all the time. Yet the tension is almost palpable. Jihad 56 is worried that his boat will not return to the port. For 8 months last year, the boat was held by Israeli authorities after its crew ventured a short distance beyond the small zone in which Gaza's fishers are permitted to operate. Being away from the vessel was heartbreaking for Jihad. Feeding our families was very hard during those months," he said, adding, "All we know how to do is in life is fish." Eventually, the boat, named Al-Hajj Rajab, after Jihad's father, was released to him under strict conditions. He was required to pay approximately $5,500 and warned that he may not go further than 3 nautical miles from the shoreline. Jihad fears that the boat could be seized once again at any moment. The Israeli regime authorities have initiated court proceedings in an effort to confiscate the boat permanently. The orgy 14th, 2022. On that day, Jihad's brother, Nihad, was captaining the boat. Nihad and other members of his extended family were lowering their nets into the sea when 3 Israeli regime naval vessels approached them at high speed. The Israelis attacked Nihad and his crew with rubber-coated steel bullets and water cannons. Once they were beside the boat, 3 Israeli regime commandos jumped on board, aiming and continuing to shoot. Nihad said, "They even used on us several times. It's a terrifying and cruel experience, not only here, but because it was sons and nephews injured and in handcuffs." All 6 fishers, including Nihad, were arrested and brought to Ashdod, a naval base in the occupied territories of Palestine. Later, the fishers were taken to the Erez military checkpoint, which separates the occupied territories and Gaza. They were interrogated before being released in the late evening. The excuse offered by the Zionist regime for its brutality was that the boat was outside the permitted fishing area. Nihad pointed out that it is often impossible to catch enough fish inside the permitted zone. Fishers have to go farther in the hope they will have a large enough daily catch. Otherwise, their activities would not be economically viable. Under the Oslo Accords signed between the Zionist regime and the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1990s, Gaza's fishers may venture up to 20 nautical miles from the shore. The Zionist regime has not respected the accords.